Hi. In a change to the programme, I will not be presented today. I'm chairing it. The APRA paper was issued yesterday at 4 o'clock, so Helen and Stuart have kindly volunteered to walk us through the key issues or the key features of the paper. Just so you know, I am the chair of the task force for the Institute that's been sort of consulting and involved in discussions with APRA on the development, and we'll be coordinating sort of responses to the paper, which are due in August 2010. But today, with the paper having only just come out yesterday, I thought it was good that Helen and Stuart will be taking us through the review of the capital standards. Helen has been at APRA for 8 years and has recently taken up the role of General Manager of Policy Development, with responsibility for oversight of all of APRA's policy development activities. And I think I remember reading your names on the paper there. Prior to that, Helen was General Manager, Diversified Institutions Division, and with supervisory responsibility for many of the licensed general insurers and some banks and insurers. And you're also chairing APRA's internal General Insurance Industry Committee. Stuart has been at APRA for just over 2 years and currently works in the Supervisory Support Division as the head of life insurance risk, managing a team of actuarial insurance risk specialists. Prior to joining APRA, Stuart was 18 years at BT Westpac as the head of most recently as the head of finance and also as the appointed actuary. I leave you to Helen. Hand over some.
Sorry, space is a bit tight back there. Good morning, everyone. Pleasure to be here, and we were very relieved to release the paper yesterday. Otherwise, it might have been a fairly short session. For those of you that haven't been on a desert island for the last year, you're probably aware that we have been undertaking a major review of both the life insurance and general insurance capital framework. And the discussion paper was released yesterday. What we're proposing to do... is quickly run through some of the background of the review for those of you that haven't been living and breathing it for the last year like we have been, give you a little bit of information about the timetable and what happens from here, and then run through some of the key proposals at a fairly high level. And hopefully we will have time for questions. I'm going to do the easy bit, talk about the concepts and leave the hard stuff about the specifics of some of the detail to Stuart. The focus of this session is actually on life insurance, although a lot of the proposals in the paper are also relevant to general insurance. And I'm happy to provide a little bit more detail in the question time for anyone who has some specific general insurance questions. The other thing I'd note is that we are planning a broader industry seminar at the end of June, which will be sponsored by IFSA and the Insurance Council, where we'll spend half a day going through the proposals in a little bit more detail after people have had more than 12 hours to digest the paper. Okay. So, again, I think we've done a lot of informal presentations and discussions with industry over the last year where we've outlined what we're trying to do. And primarily what we wanted to do in the case of both general insurance and life insurance was take a little bit of a step back, see if there was scope to align the capital frameworks more both between life and general insurance, but also where appropriate with the... ADI capital framework, the banking capital framework, trying to enhance the risk sensitivity of the capital framework. I think, you know, particularly if you look at general insurance, it was introduced in 2002. It was a big step from the very rudimentary capital framework that had been placed prior to that, but it was done as a first step, if you like, on a path towards getting more risk-sensitive capital arrangements, and it was felt that after 8 years or so, it was time to have another look at that and see if there were ways that we could fine-tune it and make it more risk-sensitive. On the other hand, we are quite mindful of not making either capital framework overly complex, and it is actually quite a challenge to balance improved risk sensitivity whilst keeping the framework and the actual calculations not overly complex. We are mindful of what's happening in the international space, and one of the questions that we often get is, are we adopting Solvency II? And if not, why not? The answer is Solvency II hasn't even been finalised yet, let alone implemented. It is one of the international developments that we look at, but it's not the only international capital framework that is out there and is worth looking at. We have, where appropriate, looked at what Solvency II is doing and some of the concepts it's using and taken those into account in developing our own framework, but we have no intention of adopting Solvency II. APRA's framework, I think, in both the general insurance and life insurance space has served us well, and we are quite comfortable with continuing to develop our own framework and just taking into account international developments as we feel it is appropriate. I think the other point that it's important to make at this stage is that we have no intent, or we certainly didn't start this review with the intent of necessarily changing the overall level of capital for either the life insurance industry or the general insurance industry. Of course, to the extent that you improve the risk sensitivity of the capital framework, there will be some impact and different impact on individual insurers. We are not changing the target level of sufficiency that we're trying to achieve in the capital framework. We are still working towards a 99.5% level of sufficiency over a one-year period in the GI space, and that will be the target for the life insurance space as well. The quiz will be key here. When we do the quiz in the middle of the year and get information on what the implications of some of our changes are, we will use that to firstly identify, you know, what the impact of the particular changes is, but also to try and get a sense of the extent to which we are actually achieving that 99.5% level of sufficiency. Caveat I would say there is, as all of you know, actually measuring that and deciding whether you are or are not achieving 99.5 or 99.75 or whatever is not an exact science. And so I think we need to be a bit pragmatic here about what the end outcome will be as well. So I guess in that sense, because there are a number of steps to follow, this is the first step, and I'll run through the timetable in a second. We don't want people being overly focused on end outcomes in responding to the discussion paper. The discussion paper is setting the framework and the concepts and the direction that we want to head, and we're looking for feedback on those concepts and principles and direction at this stage. Moving on to the timetable, it's always been an ambitious program to get this review completed, and that continues to be the case. We've just released the discussion paper. It's out a little bit later than we anticipated. We are still targeting the release of three technical papers, and we are targeting June for those, and we, albeit it's likely to be late June. We are going to undertake a quantitative impact study, which will be released in July. Our aim is to have those technical papers and the quiz out sufficiently ahead of the response closing date for the submissions on this paper, so that industry has a little bit more detail than is in the discussion paper before it has to finalise its submissions on it. You will see we've given a 3-month response time frame for submissions on the discussion paper itself, so that closes in August. We're going to give industry 3 months to complete the quiz, and we will then digest all of that with the aim of producing draft standards and a response paper to all the submissions by the end of 2010. The next stage of the project is a really it depends on where we get to based on the initial round of consultation, but our intention is to try and have final standards out by the middle of next year for implementation in 2012. We are trying to align to the extent that we can this project with some of the other policy work that's underway at APRA at the moment, so we've got a discussion paper out on conglomerate supervision, or what we call level three. Clearly, any changes to capital for general insurers and life insurers will flow through to the capital for conglomerate groups, and hence we want to try and dovetail the finalisation of these proposals with the finalisation of our conglomerate capital framework. There are also, as most of you would be aware, changes happening in the banking space around capital requirements, including in particular related to the quality and composition of capital that counts for regulatory capital purposes. APRA's practice has been to align our ADI capital requirements and general insurance capital requirements. That will be extended to life insurance, and hence, again, any changes that happen in the banking capital composition space need to flow through into where we end up with our general insurance and life insurance capital review. So all of those projects are kind of targeting sometime in 2012 for implementation. So moving on to concepts. This sort of balance sheet structure probably is not unfamiliar to those of you who've worked in the banking space or the general insurance space. We're essentially moving to the same structure for life insurance, which is you've got admissible assets on one side and you've got liabilities, required capital and surplus capital on the other side. And the key sort of components from an APRA perspective that we'll be looking at is to define required capital and define capital base, so that you can see what the relativity of those two concepts is, and hence what the surplus capital position is. So this is, if you like, actually defining a specific capital base and eligible capital. Required capital and capital base for life insurance is somewhat new, but we think it has a number of advantages in terms of transparency, alignment across industries. It facilitates our conglomerate capital framework, and so we see a lot of benefits around moving in that direction. So, the concepts are fairly straightforward here. I think, you know, required capital is simply the minimum capital that's required to achieve that target level of sufficiency that I've mentioned. The capital base is essentially what we count as eligible capital for APRA regulatory purposes, and surplus is the excess of capital base over required capital. And we also will expect all insurers to have articulated a policy around target surplus that ensures that they will always meet or always have an excess of capital base over required capital. In moving in this direction, we are proposing to have a single definition or measure of required capital for life insurance, and so we will be doing away with the current two different measures. We are making a presentational change, which is really just shifting inadmissible assets from to reduce the capital base rather than increasing required capital. The structure of required capital, again, is probably not unfamiliar to the general insurance actuaries. And it basically has five key components dealing with insurance risk, insurance concentration risk, asset concentration risk, and operational risk. And Stuart will go into a little bit more detail about some of those aspects a little bit later. You'll see that we've put up there the concept of an aggregation benefit. Conceptually, this is to recognise that there is some diversification between risk types, and that should be reflected in the capital requirements. And so we will be specifying an approach for that, focusing only on the diversification between insurance risk and asset risk, and leaving out the insurance concentration, asset concentration and operational risk. But it basically means that you know, you work out those individual components, and then you combine insurance and asset risk using a correlation matrix, and you end up with a lesser total required capital than you would otherwise arrive at. And that will be called that sum will be called the prescribed capital amount. Prescribed capital amount is effectively the rules-based capital, what will be set out in APRA's prudential standards in terms of the minimum required capital that an insurer will need to hold. We will be introducing the concept of a supervisory adjustment. Some people describe this as the Pillar 2 adjustment. In essence, it gives us the flexibility to adjust the required capital to reflect any risks that we think are not appropriately dealt with in the rules-based capital. If we feel that there are issues with the risk management or other aspects of the insurer's, you know, strategy that mean that the required capital calculation as set out in the prudential standards is inappropriate, we will have flexibility to adjust for that. I think in practice our view is that for the majority of both general insurers and life insurers, that supervisory adjustment would be zero or would be expected to be zero. But there will be some cases where we think that, a supervisory adjustment is appropriate. And the total sort of capital requirement, therefore, would be... So, if you like, the hard minimum that insurers will have to meet at all time is what we're calling the prudential capital requirement, and that will be the prescribed rules-based capital plus any supervisory adjustment. And importantly, we will be specifying that insurers will need to disclose the prescribed capital amount and the capital base, but where there is a supervisory adjustment that increases the prudential capital requirement beyond the prescribed capital amount, we would specifically be saying that that supervisory adjustment amount would not be publicly disclosed. That's the position that we take in the banking industry at the moment, and we feel that that's appropriate for insurance as well. As I said, these are the key components, and I won't go into these in too much detail, other than to note that for life insurance, there will not be a separate insurance concentration risk charge. We'll effectively include in the insurance risk calculation an allowance for insurance concentration risk. For asset risk, we are adopting a similar framework for both general insurance and life insurance, which is broadly modelled on the existing life insurance resilience reserve concept, but with some refinements which Stuart will talk about. We are tightening the asset concentration risk charges for general insurance, but leaving them unaltered for life insurance, I believe. And introducing an operational risk charge, as I've said, and I've also talked about the aggregation benefit. Just in relation to the aggregation benefit, we are seeking input on this concept, and in particular whether the benefits in terms of capital outcomes and risk sensitivity are sufficient given the additional complexity it brings to the capital calculation, and also seeking input if we are to introduce it as to what the appropriate sort of correlation factors or adjustment might be. That's it from me, and I'll now hand over to Stuart to talk over the alarm.
Okay, good timing. So as Helen said, I'm going to speak about some of the issues that are particular to life insurance. And the first one is the capital base. As Helen said, we're introducing the concept of capital base for life insurance. That will provide alignment with the current definitions for ADIs and general insurance. The capital base will include the shareholders' net assets, an approved subordinated debt, and in the case of a friendly society, seed capital. Deductions will be made for inadmissible assets, and there will also be adjustments made to the calculation of policy and other liabilities. The policy liability calculation would be adjusted to be the greater of the best estimate liability and the current termination value. And the test between the greater of the current termination value and best estimate liability would be at a policy group basis. In addition, further adjustments will be made for participating business and for non-participating business where there's a discretionary entitlement to share in investment experience. The aim of these adjustments is to ensure that policyholders' entitlements to future discretionary additions are not treated as part of the capital base. As in the existing solvency and capital adequacy calculations, there may be some requirement to adjust the other liabilities calculation where these are not at fair value. Just to briefly talk about the inadmissible assets, as you note, we're saying that that's a deduction from the capital base. At the moment in the standards, it is part of the calculation of the solvency or capital adequacy requirement. So inadmissible assets, other than that is needed to be held for asset concentration purposes, will now be a deduction from the capital base. And the definition of those inadmissible assets will be similar to what is currently in the solvency standard. The main difference proposed is that any excess of value over net tangible assets of a subsidiary, associate or joint venture will be inadmissible. And in addition to that, those net tangible assets will be reduced by any capital requirement within those entities. Let's talk about the asset risk capital charge now. Conceptually, this is very similar to the current resilience reserve that's in the life insurance standards. However, there are some differences that I'll quickly go through. First of all, there will be a separate quantification of exposures to each type of risk rather than at the moment the one calculation, which is a bundled calculation. All assets will be considered as part of the asset risk charge, not just those assets that are needed to meet the capital adequacy liability as in the current standards. The net asset value will be calculated using unstressed liability assumptions, so for example for best estimate mortality and morbidity, and a minimum termination value will apply to those liabilities. We are proposing to include two new stresses to the calculation, one for inflation and one for volatility. Then these eight individual stresses will be combined via a correlation matrix that APRA will specify. As is the case in the capital adequacy standards at the moment, hypothecation of assets will be permitted, and they'll be permitted where the value of liabilities is dependent on the value of the particular assets, such as the case in participating or investment-linked business. Now turning to the asset concentration risk charge. At the moment, as I said before, that's part of the inadmissible assets. Now under the proposal, it'd be part of the required capital. And the calculation of these will be similar to the current standards, where the values of individual assets and credit exposures, where they exceed prescribed limits, there'll be the need to hold a reserve. There are a couple of cases where we're looking to refine the calculation. At the moment, there is special consideration of mortgages. We're looking to remove those considerations and so that they just form part of the credit risk assessment. We are also proposing to allow where there is collateralisation or securitisation by a third party, that can be a reduction to the asset concentration risk capital charge. However, I would note that that would be subject to those arrangements meeting standards set by APRA. We're also looking to introduce a limit for specialist reinsurance. At the moment, a specialist reinsurer has no limit on the amount of assets that are retroceded to their retrocessionaire. We're now proposing to place a limit of 50% of the assets of the statutory fund for specialist reinsurers. We also note that there are some reinsurers who are writing direct life business. We are now going to propose that to allow for the rules for the specialist reinsurers that statutory funds must only write reinsurance business, and if a reinsurer wants to write direct business, they must do that into a separate statutory fund. Now we'll turn to the insurance risk capital charge. So the insurance risk for life insurance includes the risks of adverse changes to mortality, morbidity, voluntary discontinuance and servicing expenses. So the proposed approach to determining this insurance risk capital charge will be conceptually similar to the current standards. The current termination value minimum will continue to apply. So it will be the insurance risk capital charge will be calculated by applying margins to the best estimate liabilities and calculating the resulting increase in the liability. Some of the margins will be determined by the appointed actuary and others will be specified by APRA. The margins to be specified by APRA would be those for which we consider they should be the same for all insurers, such as a pandemic event. The margins will allow for, or need to allow for, random fluctuations in experience, extreme events, missed estimation of the mean, and adverse trends developing over time. So the new margin that is being applied as part of this proposal is that allowing for extreme events such as pandemics. I note that the margin for the random fluctuations in extreme events would only apply for the next 12 months. However, the margin for missed estimation of the mean and the adverse trends will continue over the life of the contract, as is currently the case in the standards. The appointed actuary would continue to be allowed to assume management exercises discretions in response to adverse experience, such as increasing premium rates, fees, or reducing bonus rates for participating business. However, APRA proposes to introduce some limitations on that. And what we're looking to do is to have a minimum period that elapses before any increase in fees or premiums can take place, and also to propose introducing limitations on the size of the increase. So one of the things we have been concerned about in reviewing how companies have been doing these or allowing for discretions is some companies have said, I don't need to hold a reserve because I can increase my prices and therefore I don't even do a calculation. We're also concerned about contracts where you may be in loss-making for a short period of time, but they can be recovered by profit margins 5 and 10 years into the future. So these proposals will look to eliminate both those activities that are being taken by some companies at the moment. Operational risk. Operational risk is a key risk for insurers, and so APRA believes it's appropriate to explicitly address this risk in its capital standards. We're therefore proposing to introduce an explicit capital requirement for operational risk. We note that the development of operational risk capital modelling for insurers is in early stages. Therefore, we're proposing to introduce a method for determining operational risk that will be relatively simple and it will be based on operational drivers within the business, such as premium income, assets under management, or insurance liabilities. The actual factors that will apply will inform institutions of those as part of the quiz. Discount rates. We know that the topic of risk, what is a risk-free rate? There's been much debate by market participants as to what this is. We also are very aware that the definition for general insurance and life insurance is not the same at the moment. So APRA is proposing to apply the same definition for risk-free discount rates for both general and life insurers. It is APRA's view that risk-free discount rates appropriate for varying liabilities should reflect rates that can be earned on assets that have no credit risk, are readily realisable or liquid, even in times of stress, and match the term and currency of the future liability cash flows. For Australian denominated liabilities, APRA regards the zero coupon spot yield curve of Commonwealth government securities as the best proxy for risk-free rates. Informing this view, APRA has considered the views of the Reserve Bank of Australia on the appropriateness of Commonwealth government securities yields as a proxy for the risk-free rate. In particular, the RBA has indicated to us that there is no persuasive evidence that exists to suggest that the nominal Commonwealth government security yield curve exhibits any downward bias, nor that a shallow market exists. For foreign denominated liabilities, risk-free rates should be determined with reference to yields from national government bonds in the same currency as the liabilities. We do recognise that some overseas countries, that the rating of the foreign government bonds may not be sufficient to ensure that they're risk-free. And so in these situations, we would allow other instruments to be used as long as there was an appropriate adjustment for credit risk and liquidity. The existence of a liquidity premium in the valuation of assets is generally accepted by market participants, and APRA recognises this. The argument from market participants is along the lines that if future cash flows of an insurance liability are certain, then in theory an insurer could purchase a portfolio of relatively illiquid securities to exactly match the quantum and duration of the liabilities and wait until maturity to realise the value of these assets. As long as this portfolio of assets was free from credit risk and there was no chance that the assets would need to be realised early to meet the liability cash flows, then this portfolio might be considered risk-free. APRA is following the international debate on liquidity premiums and the risk-free discount rate, and APRA may consider allowing a liquidity premium adjustment to the risk-free rate for discounting of lifetime annuities that have no provision for voluntary termination, provided that APRA can arrive at a robust method for the quantification of the liquidity premium. In my last slide, I'll just talk about some of the other changes that are occurring. APRA is proposing to remove the expense reserve and the new business reserve for life insurers. Their removal will provide better alignment between ADIs and general insurers. With tax, there are a number of areas in the capital standards where adjustments are made in relation to the tax treatment of components of the calculation of required capital in the capital base. APRA is reviewing aspects of these adjustments, including their consistency as part of the capital review. Some aspects of the proposed treatment of tax will be detailed in the separate technical papers. With regard to internal models, APRA will consider allowing the use of an internal model-based method for life insurers to determine the required capital if a number of life insurers indicate a strong desire to use such a method. I note that if APRA proceeds down this path, the key requirements for a life insurer to obtain approval for such models would be similar to the existing requirements for general insurers and ADIs. With respect to capital management, APRA proposes to strengthen the capital management practices of general and life insurers as part of the Pillar 2 supervisory process. To a large extent, these proposals build on and more explicitly articulate the existing capital management requirements, and they will broadly align with requirements in place for ADIs. The proposals will require an insurer to develop and maintain a rigorous and well-documented capital adequacy assessment process, or an ICAP. APRA proposes that each insurer will submit to APRA on an annual basis an ICAP report that addresses the capital management issues, and it will include capital projections for at least a 3-year period. And Helen stated before, there's going to be 3 technical papers which will be released towards the end of June, or hopefully released towards the end of June, and they will go into far more details about some of the issues that I've talked about today.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you, Helen. I now open questions to the floor, if anybody's one. While you're all thinking, my first question really was around the principle. I had a question around the principles that you'd used in sort of setting your standards. Solvency, for example, had a principle that it was about a wind-up situation. Cap adequacy was ongoing. What sort of principles have been used for the new capital standards proposed?
In terms of that specific, I'm aware we had a sort of a 1 in 200 versus a 1 in 400 wind-up versus going concern. In general insurance, the concept has been the 99.5% probability of sufficiency over a one-year time horizon, meaning you've got enough capital to withstand the shocks that would occur in that one-year period with a 99.5% probability and still have enough assets at the end of that one-year period to be able to run off your liabilities. And that's, in effect, the principle that's underpinning the capital proposals that we're putting forward.
Sorry, I should have said, can you please all speak to the microphone?
Mark Baxter, Commonwealth Bank. I was just intrigued by your operational risk suggestions there, and I was just curious about when we're using operational risk models that have actually already been approved as part of Basel II for a banking group, and are we actually able to get those approved for the use within a life insurer that's actually within a conglomerate group? Getting to your point about harmonisation, we're actually really keen to make sure we can actually harmonise what we do. And in effect, those models have actually already been approved by APRA, we were just wondering whether you actually had any views on that.
At this point, no. I mean, it really is wrapped up in the question of internal models for life insurers more broadly. The position we've taken in general insurance is if you want approval to use internal models, you need to have models that capture and cover all risks, and we will be taking the same approach in life insurance. And so if, as Stuart said, there is strong interest from the life insurance industry for APRA to develop an internal model approval process for life insurance, then we'll look at approval of models in respect of all risks as part of that.
Greg Bird from AMP. I've just got a question about the asset risk charges. Under the current standards, one of the benefits of the simultaneous asset shock is that it deals to the non-linearity issue within the participating funds, in that you're shocking the entire fund and you apply your discretions and you determine the level of capital that's required. Under the individual stresses, an observation would be that there's an issue where you may not have that burn through scenario hitting as often because you are applying the fund shocks individually as opposed to simultaneously. So I'm just not sure how the non-linearity is picked up there. I'm just wondering if you've got any guidance that you can give to us at this stage.
Okay, that's better. We're very aware of the non-linearity of PAR business, but also investment account business. And when the technical paper for the asset risk charges come out, it will deal specifically with how to do the calculations for PAR business and investment account business. I didn't go into it here because it's quite technical, but rest assured it will be part of that paper.
Hi, William Milner, Zurich. I just question the no new business reserve, but then the requirement to do a 3-year projection. Do you expect the company to have the capital to cover the 3 years and therefore you essentially have a reserve requirement still, or do they just get it from the parent?
No, I mean, in essence, part of the capital management planning will be to deal with the new business that is expected to be written. So it's not necessarily in required capital, but we would expect the capital management plan for the insurer to address how it would ensure that it did have the capital to meet new business assets put on the books.
So, but can that be just they get it off their parent or not?
The simple answer is it depends. But if a capital management plan just said, I'll get it off the parent, then we're likely to add a supervisory adjustment.
Craig Lamb, Suncorp. For a general insurance company, there's an assets in Australia test, which can have an impact on the amount of capital a general insurance company needs to hold. There's no such requirement for life insurance companies. I'm wondering if the committee looked at that particular issue.
Not as part of this project, no, although APRA is currently undertaking some work around the assets in Australia requirement for general insurance. I'm not saying we're going to change it necessarily, but we're looking at it. But at this stage, the current arrangements for both general and life are not being changed in those areas.
Just want to ask about the framework, if I can. In your note, you say the target surplus represents the new capital adequacy level in terms of that's your point of intervention. Is that correct? Or it says you may intervene, but I think it's more like you will intervene. And if that's the case, do we have to hold target surplus above the target surplus?
We expect target surplus policies to address what management actions will be as actual surplus is at various percentages of target surplus. So if you fell below target surplus, that doesn't mean APRA will intervene, but APRA will discuss how the level of your actual surplus is compared to your target surplus and what you said you would do in your capital management plan.
G'day, Alistair Wrong. Just a quick question. I think one of the very early aims you mentioned about setting up a risk-sensitive capital standard. And I probably just wouldn't mind kind of hearing about kind of going down that route versus a somewhat more stable capital requirement.
I think whenever you look at reviewing capital standards, you're always looking for improvements. And so one of the things we're looking for and trying to balance is simplicity versus risk sensitivity. And the way that we've tried to address that in these proposals is by, for example, in the asset risk charge, having these 8 separate calculations and then combining them via a correlation matrix. The factors that are set in the current standards, you'll be aware, for resilience reserve under CAPAD, even though CAPAD states it's 1 in 400, the resilience reserve says 1 in 100. What we're looking to do is have all the factors set at 1 in 200 and then combine them in correlation matrices. So, yes, they will be more complicated, but we feel they'll be more risk-sensitive and will be produce a better outcome for the industry.
Can I just ask about the supervisory adjustment, if I may? My understanding in the banking environment was that such an adjustment was quite common. I've heard APRA say a couple of times they expect that this will be limited and sparingly used in life insurance. So is there a change in strategy and approach here?
No, I think it actually reflects our view that the underlying required capital calculation in insurance is more risk sensitive in the first place, and hence the degree to which the capital framework, the prescribed capital calculation, responds to the risks of the particular insurers means that there will be less need for supervisory adjustments.
I've just got a question about the ICAP document. coming from a group which already has one for the banking entity, we often think it's very, very similar to the FCR. I wondered if you'd considered the relationship between the FCR and the ICAP.
Yes, we have. The FCR is a document that's produced by the actuary for the insurer, and which APRA gets a copy of. The ICAP is meant to be... the ICAP process within an insurer is meant to be the insurer's overall capital management framework. So it's meant to look at how the insurer manages its capital and the targets, the risks it wishes to take and the capital required to address those risks. And so it is produced by the organisation, not necessarily by the actuary. And the report on that process is a report to APRA on how that process is working and what the trigger levels are and that sort of thing. So, yes, there arguably is some overlap, but we see the two as having different purposes and different focuses.
I think we have room for one more question. The time.
Simple question. Will these rules clarify and make it easier to enter embedded value securitisation or financial reinsurance transactions, or not change that at all?
I expect no change.
Well, given the quick answer there, is there anybody else who would like to have the one last question?
Just a point on harmony between ADI regulation and life insurance regulation. Banks are currently able to hold substantially all of the assets on their balance sheet at historical values. I'm just wondering why that aspect of harmony, particularly given that the liquidity transformation that ADI's undertaken wasn't addressed in looking at this.
Market value versus historical value accounting issues are the subject of rigorous international debate, I guess. I think APRA is comfortable with the market value approach in the life insurance and general insurance space and will remain that way. The banking accounting framework and valuation framework is a little bit different for different historical reasons. I mean, I guess our approach has been to align where it makes sense and where it's appropriate to do so. We didn't feel it was appropriate to look at that particular aspect as part of this project.
Thank you. I think now, with the time, it's time to draw it to the close. I think the debate is, with the paper only coming out yesterday, I think the debate has some more to go, and I look forward to everybody providing feedback either directly to APRA or through the Institute. Please now, could you join me in thanking Helen and Stuart for their presentation?